The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from GQ Magazine and Pocket's Read It Later website, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to conclude Chaos at the Top of the World. As you will recall from our previous episode, writer Joshua Hammer shares the story of Reinhard Grubhofer and his descent after reaching the summit of Mount Everest in May 2019. Now, as we concluded part one, we had learned how even experienced climbers and Sherpa guides could face deadly consequences because of the many challenges posed in climbing the world's tallest mountain. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to learn whether Grubhofer and his climbing companions were able to survive their treacherous journey. Now, this story was written for GQ Magazine and then posted on the Pocket Read It Later website in February 2024. So we will now pick up where we left off last week. When I met with him this summer, Tasha Sherpa, one of the founders of the Seven Summit Treks and the youngest person ever to reach the top of Everest without using supplemental oxygen, defended the company's safety record. Now, Seven Summits had 64 clients on Everest that year, led by 100 Sherpas, and all but two had returned safely. Now, he conceded that the climbing season had not been good, but he also insisted the company's practices are sound. 2019's tragedies involved a wide range of outfitters from all over the world, including elite European agencies like Cobblers. It's not the case that companies from poorer countries are inherently more troubled or lax in their safety considerations. Still, Kuntal Joysher, the Indian climber, told me that the industry had become inundated with inexpensive agencies that cater to budget clients. Seven Summits Everest trips generally cost $38,000, according to Tashi Sherpa. The cheaper companies often have less to pay for guides and are said to employ more inexperienced crews. Now, parenthetically, he adds, Seven Summits insists that it rigorously trains its Sherpas and pays them higher than the market rate. These agencies have found a steady clientele among Indian climbers who typically have much less money to spend than Europeans and Americans and are dying on Everest at a greater rate than anyone else. Four out of the reported 11 who died in Everest in 2019 were Indians. Of the 17 who died on Nepal's 8,000-meter peaks, eight were Indian. Indians are showing up who have not climbed a 6,000-meter mountain, Joysher says, so many got frostbite. Four died this year. Clearly, there is something wrong. Grubhofer spent the last dreadful hours of May 23rd, which is the date of this particular story was written, spent the last dreadful hours of May 23rd in his own kind of agony. He'd staggered down the north side at a dreadful pace, exhausting his oxygen while waiting for others to move. Within sight of the cluster of dome tents on Camp 3, Grubhofer collapsed. He inched forward on his hands and knees in the gathering darkness, shredding his jacket on the rocks, begging for tea, water, and oxygen. He was in terrible shape, recalls Dendi Sherpa, who revived him, replenished his oxygen, and placed him in his tent with another climber. Too late to escape from the death zone, Grubhofer slept fitfully for hours with his oxygen mask strapped over his mouth and nose, then sat up around 3 o'clock in the morning, gasping for air. He felt terrible. With effort, he removed his gloves, found his headlamp, scrounged around the mess of the tent for his oxygen bottle, and checked the meter. The tank was empty. It had been nearly full when he crawled into bed. He realized he must have accidentally opened the valve all the way. He grumbled and tore off the mask in his regulator and retched. "Dendi," he croaked as the wind howled outside, "my oxygen." Grubhofer again rasped out a plea for help. Moments later, Dendi Sherpa began his standard check of his client's oxygen supplies. Entering Grubhofer's tent, he saw Grubhofer motioning desperately for assistance. Dendi looked at the meter, saw the needle was on zero, and hurriedly attached a new bottle. Grubhofer drew deep breaths through his respirator and settled back into his sleeping bag. Without the new tank, says Dandy Sherpa, Reinhardt would have died. A few dozen yards from Grubhofer, Chris Dare was thrashing about sleeplessly in his tent that night. All he could think about was getting below the death zone the next morning. He was ready to be done. He was eager to reunite with climbing buddy Kevin Hines, who had turned around before the summit push. With Everest behind him, the two were looking forward to meeting up at the cabin Hayes had built in the Maine woods. In the morning, as Dare and the group headed down the mountain, a Sherpa received a radio dispatch from Camp 1. "Kevin's gone," he told Dare. "What do you mean?" Dare asked, confused. Hines, Dare learned, had died in his tent at dawn. It might have been a coronary or a stroke or any one of the fatal afflictions that can overwhelm a climber's heart, brain, or lungs at Everest's merciless altitudes. Ustra says the coroner's report would attribute the death of the vigorous Irishman to natural causes. And by the way, Rolf Ustra was an Australian guide who was leading one of the groups during this story. Now, in Kathmandu in August of that year, long after the last mountaineers had returned home, I found the local climbing community consumed by a debate about what had gone wrong. At least four climbers died in the 24 hours that followed Grubhofer's moment at the top, casualties of interminable lines and tragic miscalculations, victims of one of the deadliest seasons the mountain has ever seen. In all, 11 would die on Everest in May. By the time I visited, the Nepalese government had proposed a new set of rules requiring, among other things, that prospective climbers provide proof of high-altitude experience. But skeptics doubted that the government would seriously enforce such reforms and risk reducing its millions of dollars in permit-generated revenues. At the end of the day, the changes that Nepal talks about never happen, Rolf Oster tells me. At the end of the day, money talks. Richard Grubhofer shares the assessment that something has to change. When I meet him in Vienna, it has been 3 months since he scaled the mountain, and he is still basking in the achievement. "I cannot go anywhere without being the one who has just done Everest," he says with a smile. Sure, more people were climbing the mountain than ever before, but reaching the top of the world continues to offer unique bragging rights, he tells me. That will never go away, he thinks. If I would meet you here and tell you I climbed, say, Annapurna, knowledgeable guys would say, "Wow, but 99.9% don't know what you're talking about," he says. Mount Everest is such a fascinating mountain, this huge monster. It is still one of the biggest adventures on the planet. It's a prestigious place. And yet the disasters that struck on that day he reached the summit cast a shadow. Nirmal Persia's infamous photo of the traffic jam on the summit ridge, he admits, has diminished the achievement in some people's eyes. I was asked about the photo when I came back, and he tells me people said, "Oh, you've also been queuing up there like it was the supermarket." Now, just to refer back to that photo, it showed dozens of climbers waiting to ascend while some others were trying to get down, creating part of the problems discussed in this story. Now we continue. New rules have been implemented, he says, to weed out the incompetent and the inexperienced, to reduce the crowds, to remove the Disneyland illusion, and bring Everest back to something approximating its pristine state. Too many people, he says, have died needlessly because of sliding standards. Let's not make it a tourist mountain, he says. Let's not spoil it even more and reduce it to a dead people and tourist. Well, of course, Grubhofer also knows that the high sticks are part of the mountain's attraction. A note of humility creeps into his voice when he acknowledges how close he had come to asphyxiating in his tent and how a single slip had been enough to end the life of his climbing partner, Ernst Landgraf. 2 days after Landgraf perished, Grubhofer tells me a small team of cobbler and partner returned to the site and gently removed the body, which was still hanging from the line. Grubhofer says they pushed and dragged it away from the trail, then found a niche in the rocks where they laid Landgraf's remains to rest, another haunting reminder of Everest's fatal allure. By the way, Joshua Hammer wrote about global animal poaching cartel in the June-July 29th issue, and he's also appeared in GQ in previous articles. So there you go. Some interesting stuff about climbing Mount Everest, and it's quite challenging. Well, our next journey is headlined, He Biked from Spain to Singapore. Now, the kindness of strangers kept him going, according to the editors. Writer Andrew Russell's article appeared in the March 20th, 2024 issue of the Washington Post. And as the editors note, Andrew Mortensen's cycling trip through Europe and Asia represented the last leg of a worldwide ride, shall we? Let's see if we can get this right, Andrew Mortensen said as he cycled toward Eastern Avenue, the northeast corner of Washington and Maryland. Mortensen had recently completed a 10,538-mile bike journey from Spain to Singapore, and by his estimate, the last section of the bike ride around the world that began 4 years ago. Yet he was enthusiastic about the unremarkable crossing. No way. This is a new state biking for me. There were no waits, he made the light, or passport checks on that sunny Saturday in February. It was a stark contrast in the many questions and occasional delays Mortensen faced at some of the 26 national borders he crossed on his ride from Europe to Asia. Many people picked up cycling to provide some relief from pandemic lockdowns, but Mortensen, feeling caged, took his hobby to an extreme. In August 2020, he began a bike journey that eventually touched four continents. First, he rode east across the width of the United States, then south as far as roads can take you in South America, and finally across the Eurasian landmass. According to the popular fitness tracking app Strava, he typically logged 100-plus miles in the saddle per day, propelled by a deep-rooted curiosity to explore. He had a long-held goal to pedal around the world, but that wasn't the source of his motivation. It's still crazy to me to think about, he said in an interview during the bike ride to Maryland. At no point was it me riding around the world. It was tomorrow I'm going to go wherever and cross the border into India. Only in retrospect does it really dawn on you. The generally accepted distance necessary for a round-the-world ride is 18,000 miles, including his earlier rides in the Americas. Mortensen had logged more than 27,000 miles. And Mortensen accomplished his rare feat with an extra wrinkle. As an openly gay cyclist, he wasn't sure how he'd be received in hostile parts of the world. He was pretty freaked out when he started, but the people he met consistently proved him wrong with their warmth and hospitality. From Washington State to Singapore, the 32-year-old Austin resident's transcontinental bike ride was the last leg in a pandemic-spanning tour that began on a cold beach in Nia Bay, Washington. After taking a voluntary exit package from a job at United Airlines and feeling, as he put it in 2022 TEDx talk, that his wings were clipped, Mortensen decided to bike across America. The ride east, which he completed in Yorktown, Virginia in October 2020, was followed shortly thereafter by one south. First to Key West, Florida, and from there to Texas, and then down to literal end of the road in Chile's Route 7. He completed the Pan-American portion of his trip around Villa O'Higgins in April 2021 after some 16,912 miles in the saddle. But Mortensen was not done. After a break for business school at the University of Texas at Austin, he resumed his journey last July, that would be 2023, in Pamplona, Spain, with a goal of making it to Croatia. 6 months later, after cycling beyond Europe and into the likes of Turkey, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, China, Pakistan, and Nepal, his parents set up a warm welcome for him as he rode into Singapore's Marina Bay Sands Resort. He did take breaks, off the bike. He spent a week with his boyfriend after the European portion of his ride. He took 2 weeks with family for his grandfather's funeral, and then 10 days off at Christmas for family time and needed bike repairs. Rounding the corner into Marina Bay after his last 23.9 miles from Malaysia, Mortensen felt sad that his journey was at an end, but he was also hopeful for our world and happy to give my bum a rest, he adds. Well, sublime landscapes and big hearts is the next section. Cycling through suburban Maryland presents few opportunities for grand vistas or big coals, French for mountain pass. The highest point on Mortensen's long ride was circling the base of Conger Tag at 13,467 feet in the Pamir Mountains of western China. Now, he pedaled over to this little cliff, and there before me is this massive glacier on the left, open plains in the front of it. Absolutely just stunning, Mortensen said. It was like, oh my gosh, this is just sublime. The photos he posted to Strava offer a tour of amazing peaks, expansive vistas, and UNESCO World Heritage sites. And he adds parenthetically his advice, go to the ones the tourists don't. Now, in France, Mortensen wrote of cycling through a landscape that builds from stony, arid coast into a crescendo of soaring peaks, wild topography, and lush colors. 2 days, or excuse me, 2 months later, he rode across the arid Usturet Plateau in Uzbekistan on a road with no turns for more than 100 miles. Now, his photos show off lots of friendly people. Borders are pretty subjective, he said, unless there's a river or mountain range when they draw a squiggly line between the two countries. A lot of the time, people are just culturally and ethnically the same, and there's just a line. In a digital diary he kept on Strava, Mortensen noted cycling along one disputed Central Asian border where there was only a fence, and often not even that. At times, he could only guess which country he was in. Though the landscape on my route at this point might not be jaw-dropping, the big hearts are, he wrote on Strava one night in Central Asia. I talk a lot about these people because it feels so wildly different from the world we see in the news right now. Their continued grace towards this complete stranger is a powerful reminder of that common refrain, there's a lot more that connects us than divides us. Conflict dominated the headlines as Mortensen wrote, the war in Ukraine, the Hamas attack on Israel, the Israel-Gaza war, and tensions between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Mortensen kept writing. He recounted the numerous invites to tea he received, conversations via Google Translate. Crowds eager for a picture with the lone cyclist. People were so excited to see me, he said. The excitement was also exhausting. A self-described introvert, Mortensen would end his days exhausted from the physical exertion of cycling and the many social interactions along the way. He spent 24 nights of his 5 months on the road in people's homes, and the rest in hostels and inns to unwind. Of the many people he met along the way, one that stood out was a welcoming Uzbek who, after they spent hours together at a border crossing, invited him to his sister's wedding. This guy was just the nicest person ever, Mortensen said. He just invited a stranger into one of the most important moments for his family just like that, on a lark. It made me realize that maybe I don't have to worry about all these people around me. Food, a necessity for any endurance athlete, was often less than glamorous. Grab-and-go options, cookies, chips, and the occasional ice cream were staples of his days. But when he spied the golden arches on a dusty road outside of Amritsar, India, he wrote of being overjoyed to stop for a veggie burger, fries, and a shake. Risk for a gay cyclist. Cycling past Maryland's Lake Artemisia, Mortensen relayed an experience that he had with a clerk at a pit stop in the eastern Mediterranean country. After chatting for a few moments, the clerk added him on Instagram, and then when that happens, it's pretty clear right away who I am and what I stand for, he added. Mortensen's Instagram profile includes links to his advocacy for the Trevor Project, a nonprofit that works to prevent suicide among LGBTQ youth, as well as other references to his sexuality and advocacy. Many countries where he wrote in the Middle East and Central Asia explicitly outlaw same-sex relations, according to the Human Rights Watch, and even in those where it is not illegal, it is not necessarily welcome. Turkey, for example, does not bar same-sex relations, but its president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is an outspoken critic of LGBTQ people. The clerk realized Mortensen was gay instead of the negative response the cyclist feared. The clerk told him that he, too, was gay. Such was the disconnect Mortensen found among national politics and laws and the hospitable treatment he received throughout the journey. Someone who sees you outside and it's cold or it's late or there's no food for 50 miles, that overrides any beliefs about who you are and where you're from, he said. Mortensen was aware of the risk. LGBTQ events have faced violent protests, and individuals have been jailed or killed in some of the countries along his route. He did not publicly advertise he was gay. There was no pride flag on his bike. He never mentioned his sexuality or boyfriend in his public Strava post. French students Jacques de Mastre and Joseph Serde, who met and cycled with Mortensen in Uzbekistan and again in Malaysia on their way to a business school course in Singapore, said they only became aware of his sexuality and advocacy when they looked him up online. I think he was right, de Mastre said. You never know the direction of people. Was Mortensen the first openly gay person to bike around the world? Well, that's difficult to judge. If an LGBTQ individual has done it, they have not made a point of publicly sharing their sexuality. Lael Wilcox, a well-known ultra-endurance cyclist who is a lesbian, said in an email that she does not know of any other LGBTQ individuals who have completed an around-the-world ride. Wilcox is planning her own global circumnavigation ride this summer when she attempts to set a new women's record of 110 days. I feel that it's important for our community to have visibility, to have people that are out there doing the same things that everyone else can do, Mortensen said. A record in spirit. An around-the-world ride to the Guinness Book of Records and other official record keepers is more than just cycling 18,000 miles. Other criteria include traveling in a continuous direction, crossing two antipodes or opposite points of the Earth, and beginning and ending at the same point. Mortensen's ride meets all but the last, as he began and ended on the edge of the Pacific Ocean in Washington State and ended in Singapore. Mortensen, however, does not seek an official Guinness or other record. It was really just about the ride itself. Bike travel can be arduous, scary, sometimes even monotonous, but the excitement of encountering the totally unexpected makes it worth every minute, he wrote on Strava. And Mortensen adds, and the best part, you can dismount at any moment to soak it all up. Quite a ride for that young man. Well, picture a group of men on horseback wearing black jackets and wide-brimmed hats, and they ride a dusty road with the sun shining through the trees. Now, toward the camera behind them, as all this takes place, well, they are among the pilgrims on horseback riding through Doñana National Park. Now, our next article, Flamenco and Fervor, Inside Spain's El Rocío Pilgrimage, was written by Anna Hart. Now, the photographs were taken by Kevin Fangenart, and the story was part of the New York Times ongoing series, The World Through a Lens, published May 8th, 2023. So let's see what they've enjoyed. And as we go through this park here, let's see. In our World Through the Lens column, photojournalists help transport you, according to the Times, virtually to some of our planet's most compelling places. And this week, Kevin Fangenart and Anna Hart, share an essay from southern Spain. Now the story. You can't wear that flamingo dress for the El Rocío pilgrimage, Bonita. Maria Cardenas, our Airbnb host, said with a laugh, you'll die in the heat. Well, she pinched the thick red fabric between her thumb and held it up to my face like a specimen. You see, heavy, tight dresses like this are made for the festivals at the Bullring in Seville City, she explained. You need lightweight, stretchy polyester for pilgrimage, for riding, walking, dancing, siestas in the grass. The El Rocío pilgrimage is a high-octane religious spectacle, a multi-day annual fiesta held in Andalusia, the southernmost region of Spain. Flamenco dresses, caravans, and religious fervor that seems to grow even stronger, or ever stronger, despite the ever-waning influence of the Catholic Church. Now, the participants can spend months in preparation, planning menus, hiring tractors, arranging for caravans. It also requires the selection of a dress that permits the wearer to relieve herself behind a bush while excluding all the elegance of Goya's Duchess of Alba. Having studied for a year in Seville in 2012, Kevin, my collaborator, has long dreamed of returning to document the pilgrimage of El Rocío, which was canceled for two consecutive years during the pandemic. My connection to Spain is more recent. I moved to Mallorca last year after deciding that life is too short not to live on a Mediterranean island. Kevin and I regularly worked together on travel assignments, and when he told me about El Rocío, it was an easy yes, because the best way to get to know a new country is to party with it. Although we were documenting the 2022 pilgrimage, and 2023 was held at the end of May, we were also participating in a celebration. Andalusia, famed for flamenco dancing, cowboy culture, and pilgrimage, had a distinct seductive identity that people in the south of Spain are rightly proud of. The El Rocío pilgrimage is arguably the most potent visual representation of Andalusian culture, and it's this as much as religious zeal that propels hundreds of thousands of pilgrims toward the shrine of the Virgin in the village of El Rocío. Some travel on foot, others atop elaborately decorated caravans. Many are on horseback. Stiff-backed and spiffily attired riders in wide-brimmed hats, high-waisted paseo trousers, and cropped gayabera jackets. On our first day, Kevin and I wandered through the Dunyanya National Park, some 40 minutes south of central Seville, foraging for the pilgrims. We were assured there would be there. And eventually, we heard the faint, like tinkle of cowbells, the clap of horses' hooves, creaking caravan wheels, the strains of flamenco guitar, voices singing in unison. Within minutes, the dusty road had transformed into a festival. Caravans rolled past, pilgrims pressed bottles of Crescampo beer, and slices of cured Iberico ham into our hands. The singing reached a crescendo. Now, in Spain, Catholicism is taken seriously, but so's beer, ham, and cheese, even at 10 a.m. Many Andalusian cities, towns, and villages developed their own pilgrimage, known as Romerias, as so named because pilgrims traditionally walked to Rome, dedicated to their particular patron saints. But the four-day walk to El Rocío has achieved cult status. According to the legend, the statue of the Virgin Mary was discovered in a tree trunk by many hundreds of years ago in the marshes of the Guadalquivir River. For a couple of centuries, devotion to the shrine was confined to the surrounding towns of Almonte and Villamanrique de la Condesa. But by the 20th century, in celebration of Pentecost, Hermandades, the brotherhoods of pilgrims, were walking up to 4 days to get to the area, from the area surrounding Seville and Huelva, and eventually beyond Andalusia, from Madrid, Barcelona, and Balearic and Canary Islands. At night, the Hermandades would camp in the forest, dine together at long tables, and dance flamenco around campfires until the reality of next day's 15-mile hike could not be ignored. Kevin and I share an obsession with international festivals. His impulse is to capture portraits, mine's to listen and learn. But wherever we go, Kevin and I tend to fixate on the faces. At El Rocío, no faces were closed to outsiders. We were invited into caravans, told to sit in each stew and sliced watermelon, dragged into flamenco dances, and instructed to take a siesta after lunch in the grass. Otherwise, we'd never survive until Sunday, one participant told us. No one we encountered was reluctant to be interviewed or photographed. Everyone seemed to accept that El Rocío is a spectacle. Our amazement and curiosity was received as a sign of respect. We joined the caravans in muddy waters at Quema, a ford in the Guadalquivir River, a tributary of the Guadalquivir, in the town of Villamanrique de Condesa. Every restaurant and bar was spilling over with spectators, and El Rocío was televised like a sporting event throughout Spain. On Friday night, the first of the Hermandades arrived in Rocío, a tiny town that reminded me of Western movie sets that I've seen in California and Arizona. Its character entirely shaped by the pilgrimage. The more prominent Hermandades, like Huelva, with its 10,000 pilgrims, own huge boarding houses at the edge of town with convent-like rooms and vast communal dining and dancing areas. So lots of fun there for El Rocío. A good spirit and a good tradition, writes the author. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And the Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again, ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please direct them to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.